Boy. Okay. I would be happy to answer questions if you have them, or to hear comments. If you have questions or comments, maybe you could raise your hand and then see if it's a little dark out there. So if you'd wave your hand, I could see you more easily and recognize you. Yes.
Why are you so fascinated, or how? When did you become fascinated with building a kid?
Did you all hear the question? When did I and how is it that I became interested in Billy the Kid? I guess I don't know. I grew up in Billy the Kid country. I had heard all of my life, about stories about Billy the Kid. And he became, in time, this happens to children, I think, especially children who live alone. I was an only child, and consequently, I spent a lot of my time alone. And I made up games on my own, and I learned how to exist in that way, on the strength of my imagination. And so Billy the Kid was just made to order. He excited my imagination when I first heard about him, and then I began to draw him into my experience, to appropriate his presence as I imagined it into my sphere of instinct, as it were. And then the fascination grew. And there came a time when I researched Billy the Kid. I began reading things about him, looking for things, and really trying to get some possession of the details of his life, of which, as you know, there are very few. We know very little about him. His name was really Henry McCarty, apparently. We know very few things about his life. So he is appropriate to imagine. He lends himself to an imaginative realization. And I have indeed lived a long time with Billy the Kid. I know him probably as well as any living man does. I also know Genghis Khan, but we won't get into that now. I'll just tell you this much. I was sitting in the Bolshoi Theater one night, and Genghis Khan was sitting directly in front of me, and I was chatting with a friend seated on my right, and directly, Genghis Khan turned around, and he fixed me in his gaze, and he memorized my face. It was the most incredible stare I have ever encountered, and it became excruciating. I can't tell you how I squirmed under that man's gaze. I knew more about that thing I was reading to you about Billy the Kid's gaze after that experience. And I know that was Genghis Khan. It could not have been anyone else. You can't imagine that. Maybe you can. Maybe it has happened to you. I don't know. But he looked at me for what seemed fully 5 minutes. Just no expression, just looking at me, fixing me in his mind somehow, memorizing me. Boy, I didn't move a muscle, just sat there and was miserable. Are there other questions? Why aren't you asking questions? Yes?
Could you give your views on the difference between poetry and prose?
Well, I think, yeah. Could I give my views on the difference between poetry and prose? Poetry is an expression that is composed in verse. And that's about as much as you can say, I think, about the technical distinction. Prose is not measured, is not metrical. Poetry is. One of the controlling devices in poetry is the length of line, and that simply is not a factor in prose. Beyond that, I think all you can do is talk about characteristics, alliteration, rhythm, what we call the lyrical quality, accrues to poetry more readily, let us say, than it does to prose. But as far as I can tell, the two expressions are very closely related. Very closely related. I think there is a kind of prose which might as well be called poetry, simply because the characteristics, the texture of the language is such that it has the sound and the appearance of poetry. Not the stanzaic appearance on the page, but everything else. And I'm thinking of such things as Moby Dick, the chapter on the spirit spout, which is almost overburdened with alliteration, but you read through that and you hear it, and that becomes the essence of it, the sound. It is poetry of a kind, I think. Isaac Dinesen, too, in such a work as Out of Africa. That's very poetic, and there is very little to choose between that and poetry of a very high order. Anything else? Yes? I read Wallace Stevens, and I read Emily Dickinson. I read E.A. Robinson. I read Robert Frost, William Carlos Williams. And among the contemporary poets, I read Tom Gunn, of whose work some of it I think is very, very fine. I have read Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. I read J.V. Cunningham, again, a man whose talent I respect a great deal. Edgar Bowers, who is perhaps a little too... Are we being taped? I shouldn't say anything like that. He's great. He's fantastic. Those are the people who come first to mind, though. At one time, I fell hopelessly in love with Emily Dickinson. And I'm one of the few people in the world to have read Emily Dickinson in manuscript. And I spent a year doing that. I went to Amherst once upon a time, and I divided my time between the Frost Library at Amherst and the Houghton Library at Harvard, and I read Emily Dickinson in manuscript. It's a fascinating experience. I haven't, I've sort of, our relationship has cooled a little bit. But at one time I was, it was an obsession almost. Any other questions? Yes?
Yeah. After reading some of your other works, I didn't imagine that you would be laughing or would make me laugh. I just wondered if humor is something that's new in the poetry you just write, especially with Billy the Kid. and you're traveling Europe?
I don't know. No, I don't think it's new. I don't think it, you know, you can, I don't think you can ascribe it to any recent experience. I was funny as hell long before I wrote Billy the Kid. But your question, I understand that question, because not until fairly recently have I begun to deal in humor at you know, I didn't, for example, my first poems, I should say this too, you know, these poems, I have maybe 45 or 50 poems here. They will be in the collection, it will be that size. But three quarters of that number are recent. That is to say, they were written in the last, say, 3 years. And the other quarter, poems, say, 12 or 15 poems, were all written long before that. So there's a great gap in here. I hope it's not too obvious. But something wonderful happened to me about 3 years ago. I don't know what it was, but my reaction to it was that I began to write at a much greater rate. I became suddenly very energetic in terms of writing. It took me about 15 years to write those first 15 poems. And I liked to say to people that I was probably the slowest poet around. You know, I took a kind of refuge in that interesting fact. But now I'm writing much more loosely, and I don't know whether that's good or bad. I think it is probably good, in that I feel, you know, it is somehow a greater impulse, and the humor is a real aspect of it. I like to laugh at what I write, at least on occasion. I also like to curdle with fear, you know. I like to amaze myself when I'm writing, too. After I had written this poem, The Wound, for example, I stood back, you know, and I wondered about that for a long time. It was amazing to me that I had written that poem, and I liked being amazed in that way, you know, so I looked at it, read it a lot, carried it around and read it to people, you know, accosted people on the street and said, listen to this. You know. I don't know. I don't know really the answer to that. There is very little humor in much of my writing, but there is a good deal in my more recent writing, and I don't know how to account for that. Yes.
When you won the prize, did you make an acceptance speech?
No.
Could you comment about
that? Yes. The question is, when I won the Pulitzer Prize, did I make an acceptance speech? No. As a matter of fact, you don't. You're not given the opportunity. I should have been glad to make an acceptance speech. I was rather hoping that someone would ask me to make an acceptance speech. But as it happens, the Pulitzer business is all very secret. This is true. Most people find this hard to believe, but I did not know that I was under consideration for the Pulitzer Prize. It never occurred to me. And so the news came out of the clear blue, and I was taken completely by surprise. I could not have been more surprised. I had just never thought about the Pulitzer Prize. I never thought that I had something that the Pulitzer people were considering, were judging. And one day, the 5th of May, the 5th of May, 1969, My editor at Harper & Row, Fran Monson McCullough, called me on the telephone. I was at Santa Barbara at the time. And she called me in the late morning. It was 11 o'clock, say. And she said, Scott, are you sitting down? And I said, yes, Fran, what is it? I wasn't. I was standing. I was standing up. It was a wall phone. And she said, you've just won the Pulitzer Prize. And I said, sure I have. You know. But then she convinced me of it, and I was just dumbfounded. Just really, really dumbfounded. But it's all very secret. To this day, I don't know who the people were on the committee, except for one or two. I've managed, you know, with great effort and brilliance, I might add, to discover the identities of one or two people on that committee, you know, because I am indebted to them. But it's all very secret. They notify you, I think, by wire. Right? You hear about it, though, before you get the wire. It was on the radio just after Fran called me. And people started running up and saying, I just heard the news. And I said, me too. And then the awards are made, as you probably know, by Columbia, the trustees of Columbia University. And they mail you a check for $1,000. And a certificate which says, you know, the trustees of Columbia University award the Pulitzer Prize in fiction to so-and-so this day, and there's a seal on it. But they send you that in a plain brown wrapper, and that's all there is to it. There is no ceremony, and I didn't have the opportunity to make an acceptance speech. Wonderful things happened to me just after that, but not as a part of the Pulitzer business. My publisher, you know, they were overjoyed. They hadn't had a Pulitzer Prize in 20 years or something. So, you know, they invited me. They were very expansive. They invited me to New York, and they put me on television shows and things like this. You know, they were just overjoyed. And I got around to asking my editor, how is it that books are selected? You know, I didn't know that my book was under consideration. How are they chosen? Who determines which books will be submitted? And she said, oh, the sixth floor receptionist gets together a group of books every year and sends them on. Very casual about it. So I went up, I made it a point to pay my respects to the sixth floor receptionist, thank you. It's very funny, though. Really very funny. I wouldn't, I'd do it again. Any other questions? Yes?
Would you describe the land around Rainy Mountain?
The land around Rainy Mountain is very, flat, level, in the main. That area is called the Rolling Plains, and it's called that because the land, there is an undulation to the land. It does, in fact, roll. But you can see great distances over it, of course. And it is Great Plains country, very much like the country of the Northern Plains, except that it is probably a little more undulant. There are fewer mountains in it, and there are many rivers, green belts along creeks and rivers. Rainy Mountain is just a little knoll. It's, I don't know what its elevation is, but it's in the Rockies. You would not think of it as a mountain at all. It's a knoll, a hill. But from the top of it, you have the sense that you are on top of the world because you can see great distances from the top of it. Grassland. At one time, you know, buffalo range. And as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things about that country now is that there is a game preserve at Medicine Park, which is in the Wichita Mountains, just close by Rainy Mountain. There's a herd of buffalo there. I've been chased by one of the buffalo in that herd. That's, you know, I don't tell that to everybody, and I don't want it to get around. But one day my father and I were walking, we were driving through Medicine Park, and we saw the herd, which you can't always do because sometimes it ranges far away from the road, but this time it was close. And it was in the spring, and many of the cows had just calved, and there were these marvelously beautiful orange-colored calves, buffalo calves, lying in the grass. And so my father and I got out of the car, and we started walking over to get a closer look. And we got within, say, 10 or 15 feet of a calf, and then its mother took exception to us. And she put down her head, and she charged, you know. And we got the hell out of there. I didn't know that my dad could run as fast as he can. He's terrific. He was doing about a 9.3 100. She didn't chase us very far, you know. No real enmity. She just wanted to establish her territory. Impress her calf, you know. Anything else? Yes?
Just talking about Rainy Mountain, I just wondered if you had any suggestion as far as quest, as far as realizing place, for like people that like live in Tucson. I don't know if you've been out on Speedway Boulevard and realizing place in that kind of term, those kind of terms. If you have a suggestion, like where people could go.
I think that it is possible for all of us at this point in time to develop a sense of place. It is easier for some of us. And he told me the last time I saw him, he said, you know, they're doing some construction work out here. They're tearing down buildings, and they were digging up a sidewalk. And he said, it was an interesting thing to see the children in the neighborhood. They all gathered around because underneath this concrete, there was dirt, you know? And it had never occurred to them that that earth was there under that concrete wrapping. And I think more and more, that is happening to us, and it will happen to us more and more still, you know, in the future. But we can realize and must realize that there is earth underneath the sidewalk, and it is still possible to find it, and we must be sure that it remains there to be found by us and by our children and by their children. We can do that. I think your question indicates the concern, and thank God for it. You know, we are really beginning to sense our impoverishment in that respect, and that's the first step. The next is to do something about it. And I don't think legislation is the next step. I think rather the next step is developing a moral understanding of the landscape. We must understand the landscape in the way that the Indian traditionally understands it, as a vital thing, as a thing possessed of a spirit of its own. The Indian has always had a great ethical regard for the earth and sky, and I think we stand to learn a great deal, and perhaps even to save ourselves by following his example. Well, I could, you know, go on and on about that. I have kept you a very long time, and I appreciate your questions, and I have enjoyed chatting with you. Thanks for coming.
Professor Momaday will be in the Poetry Center, which is on Highland Street at Speedway tomorrow afternoon from 2 o'clock, perhaps until 4, to talk with those of you who are interested in talking with him further. You're invited. Thank you for coming.